And nuclear physicist and UFO investigator Stanton Friedman is standing by. He will join me very shortly with info on next week's 58th anniversary celebration of the Roswell crash in the desert outside of New Mexico. He'll also be disclosing some new information that's come to light on the MJ-12 documents that will be included in a brand new revised issue of his book, Top Secret Magic. Now, that is due to hit bookstores very soon. Stanton Friedman, next on Coast to Coast AM. Stanton T. Friedman received his bachelor's and master's degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and in 1956. That's where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet, General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, highly classified, and eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and nuclear power plants for space. Now, since 1967, Stanton has lectured on the topic of UFOs at more than 600 colleges and over 100 professional groups in 50 states, 9 provinces, and elsewhere in the world. He's often referred to as the father of Roswell and was the very first to investigate the incident beginning in 1978. He's been actively investigating UFO incidents since the mid-1950s. Mr. Stanton Friedman, welcome back to Coast AM.
Glad to be on again, despite the crazy hour.
I know. It is late to some places and early in others. Now, the Roswell Crash Festival is coming up next week, and it's hard to believe it's already been 58 years. And I have a feeling you're going to be there.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Wouldn't miss it for the world. They asked me to come, so of course I will be there. And, you know, it's going to be hot in the desert, but it's going to be interesting as usual. Every year, you know, a variety of people show up there. You get new leads on the story. The media show up. I'm going to be meeting and greeting people off, you know, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, big July 4th day. And there will be a panel on Roswell with Don Schmidt and Tom Carey on Saturday evening. And there will be, I'm hoping with his fingers and toes crossed, a real surprise for people, because I'm expecting that Dr. Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr. will be there. Jesse has been serving in Iraq, believe it or not. He was called in last year at the age of 67. He's been in the reserve for 32 years, and he's got some leave coming, and I'm expecting to see him. We're supposedly going to be grand marshals together of the big Roswell parade.
All right.
We wave at the kids.
Now, you mentioned Jesse Jr. Now, can you tell us the story again real quick about, you know, his involvement? His father was actually on the scene when craft
went
down.
Not only was his father on the scene, but he actually, his father, Major Jesse Marcel, was the intelligence officer for the 509th.
Right.
The only atomic bombing group in the world, the most elite military group in the world. They dropped the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, tested two more in the Pacific in 1946. And Jesse Sr. Was out at the site and brought back some wreckage from there. Jesse Jr. was, he woke his son up, who was only 11 at the time. And he remembers handling pieces of the material. He has described the strange symbols that were on the sort of I-beam-shaped pieces that had the weight of balsa wood. Weight of. They were not balsa wood, as some people keep trying to say. You know, heavy as lead and light as balsa. He handled the material. A couple days later, his dad tells him everything is classified, don't talk about it, and so forth. And interestingly enough, on the rather, how shall I put this, the show I didn't like, the...
Are you talking about the Peter Jennings UFO special?
Yeah. They interviewed Jesse Jr., but they never bothered to mention that he was a medical doctor, a colonel in the reserve, fought in Vietnam, is a helicopter pilot, you'd think all those things would go toward credibility, wouldn't you? At least I would think if somebody told me, here's a guy who was a colonel in the military and 32 years connection with the reserve and is a medical doctor, I think this is somebody I want to listen to. Well, I've been in Jesse Jr.'s home as well as Jesse Sr.'s home, and he's somebody certainly I want to listen to. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing him. And, you know, it does force you to ask the question, how desperate are we getting if we have to bring back in 67-year-old guys? You know, he didn't complain. I want to stress that. Jesse didn't complain. He loves to fly. I mean, sure, he's got to wear a flak jacket and a helmet and a sidearm all the time. And one day he went back to his trailer there in Anaconda, Base Anaconda, and a few minutes later there was a big explosion. A third trailer down had just been blasted to smithereens by the artillery. Not a fun time in Iraq, especially. It gets a little warm there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not expecting Roswell to be hot. But not like Iraq.
Well, I'm glad to hear that he is okay.
Well,
now, I understand. Oh,
yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, just that as far as I know, and, you know, everything's day-to-day in Iraq.
Well, that's true.
It's not as if nothing is happening over there. There's a lot happening, much of it not good, obviously. And, you know, that has nothing to do with UFOs per se. But knowing Jesse, I'm really looking forward to seeing him. And, you know, it'd be kind of fun to sit in a convertible in Roswell and wave during the parade.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a very good time. And when is that happening then, this coming weekend?
Yeah, starts officially on Friday this weekend. I leave here on, I go from beautiful downtown Bangor, Maine. I just drive down there and then catch flights and then drive from Albuquerque down to Roswell. Good highway for anybody who's planning on coming. And, oh, there is another surprise, too. I don't know whether people have heard of this or not. I've been traveling quite a bit myself. But the museum, the International UFO Museum and Research Center, has announced that they've purchased a prime hunk of land in the middle of Roswell and are raising funds for a new, larger, improved museum. And it's, I have to tell you this, there's a new McDonald's restaurant there. Now, ordinarily, that wouldn't be big news. However, this one is built in the shape of a flying saucer.
Of a flying saucer.
Right across the street, the new museum will be there. But that tells you something if McDonald's is willing to break with a certain amount of tradition, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. They're definitely taking the best of it with the history surrounding the town there. Now, I understand a couple of years ago, there was a group who actually did some excavations at the supposed site of the crash in 1947. Are you aware of that and what kind of, you know, information they were able to obtain from that?
Well, I remember the picture from the Sci-Fi Channel movie of the, I'll call it the armored trucks carrying samples of the dirt into the bank before they were going to be looked at by, that was the University of New Mexico archaeology department. And they were looking for bits and pieces of this or that, anything strange. And not much has come out of that so far. And, you know, you sift the soil and see what's there besides maybe a Coke bottle or can, you know. No matter where you go in New Mexico, you will find some evidence of past visitation by Earthlings, you know. But they haven't found any really exciting stuff so far. That doesn't mean there's nothing there, but, you know, the word we got from people involved in the case was that the government, the way it was put, was vacuumed the desert.
Right.
You know, soldiers arm to arm, fingertip to fingertip, moving across the land and picking up anything that was there. And so, you know, maybe we're lucky. There are sinkholes out there in some locations and some places the wind carries pieces of the lightweight foil-like material, not the I-beams I was mentioning with Jesse, but and little critters in the ground. I'll call them mice. There are other things there, too.
Prairie dogs.
Well, not so many prairie dogs. It's awful dry for them. But so, you know, I'm not saying nobody will ever find anything out there. But one point I try to make to people is that everybody says, hey, where's that real crash site? And I say it's out that way. And let's face it, there are a good 10,000 square miles of identical land all around the area there. As a matter of fact, I'll be doing, I'm told, a four-hour session with a Discovery Channel TV production team out there, and they have agreed you don't need to be at the exact location to tell the story, because there's no way you can tell the difference between that location and all that other land out there.
No way to find out.
Yeah, there's no landmark in the sense of, oh, near the big oak tree. There aren't any oak trees there. There aren't any trees there. So, you know, people are always saying, you know, I want to go right to the site, as if it was, there was something mystical about it. And in a sense, I just came back late tonight from New Hampshire. And while there, I was with Betty and Barney Hill's niece, Kathy, and we went out with the production team to the exact location where the Betty and Barney Hill abduction was took place. Now, there's trees all over the place, except in this clear area. There's a house there now, but it was clear when Betty and Barney were there. And, yeah, it's good to see the site, you know, to get a handle on what did things look like to Betty and Barney. What were the circumstances?
Sure.
There's nothing special about it in the sense of what an extraordinary place. You know, I'm not one who's subject to vibes from this, that, or the other thing. It's a little more information. I've been interested in the case since I met Betty and Barney in 1968, which is a long time ago. And, of course, I've seen Betty many times since Barney's dead. But that story is still a very important story. But people shouldn't get all caught up in making shrines out of places. You know, that's not what's important. It's what happened. Important.
Right. Now you also just took part in a recent conference on dolphin and ET civilizations in Hawaii that was held earlier this month. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Joan Ocean, who, you know, maybe because of that name, has been swimming with dolphins for many, many years, and she organized this conference, and I got asked to go, and so I did, and I'll tell you, I was surprised about a couple of things. One of them was, we went out on a boat ride, one of these 14-foot Zodiac boats, you know, and to be with the dolphins. Now, I hate to admit it, but I'm not a swimmer. But the people who were swimmers on the boat did go in the water with snorkeling gear, and it was incredible to see. We were near a pod of 200 dolphins, mostly spinners. There were some spotted ones, too. And to watch these guys swimming around and then leaping out and spinning, and to talk to the people who were in the water. And I talked to the captain of the boat, and he's been involved in a lot of research projects. And there's no doubt there's something very special about dolphins and how they communicate, how they understand what's going on with people, whether it's just their sonar or some larger picture. They seem to project their I'll call it thoughts, I don't know what else to call it, in with sonar, in holograms, kind of. And they are remarkable beings who are extraterrestrial. That is, they're not of the land, clearly, and they don't build things with their flippers. But they can tell when a woman is pregnant in the water.
Now, that's amazing.
And people who were there, I was surprised because I didn't know what to expect. You know, people who love to swim and they're out in the ocean and, you know, Hawaii's a beautiful place, all that sort of thing. But that this form of intelligence is as spectacular as it is, according to all people who get involved in these things. That surprised me a bit. And I gave a paper there about Roswell, as it happens, Roswell and MJ-12, an update. But we really enjoyed the visit to the Big Island. My wife went with me, which is very unusual, but she enjoyed it too. and some old friends of ours. Well, somebody who's been on your program, Jim Berkland and his wife mm-hmm. were there, you know, with the earthquake predictions.
Right.
And so, well, my wife and his wife have known each other for several decades, let's put it that way. And they were at our wedding 30 years ago, so, you know, old friends. And it was quite special, and I don't know whether there's going to be another one, but I certainly wrote Joan saying, hey, if there is another one, I want to go.
So people believe that there is some sort of connection then between dolphins and ET civilizations?
That seems to be a fairly widely held belief. You know, I've met John Lilly, who was the first to really do a lot of research, you know, scientific research on dolphins and their incredible intelligence and communication skills and stuff. And I was very favorably impressed. I didn't know what to expect. This was on, would you believe, the Merv Griffin Show. And three of us nutty scientists, Dirk Pearson about nutrition, John Lilly about dolphins, and me about UFOs. And I was so surprised at what a wonderful show that turned out to be. Merv's a bright guy, and he listens, and he asks questions, and live audience, and so that got me interested in dolphins, and I read one of John's books, and then seeing these creatures, we tend to restrict our thinking to those who are like us, I suppose, and, you know, it's easy to poo-poo something like a dolphin as truly intelligent creatures, but you know, I said they can tell when women are pregnant, but also if you've had a joint replaced, for example, they can tell that too. That's pretty shrewd thinking, you know, and paying attention. And so it was impressive.
Now, what is the connection that people are trying to make, though? Is it the fact that, you know, reports are from people who have had some sort of an encounter with an ET that, you know, there's no verbal speaking that is being relayed between the two, and that, as you just mentioned, these dolphins appear to somehow know things about their surroundings and people. Is that the connection people are trying to make?
Well, I think that, and the fact that their thinking seems, in some instances, I'll call it, to be of a higher order, if you will. You know, going over the Hill case, as I did this very afternoon, reminds us, as we went over that, that the aliens seem to be able to control the actions of Betty and Barney and other abductees. I'll call it mentally, because they weren't putting a gun in anybody's back or a knife, you know, an earthling approach to how do you control human behavior. but seem to be able to send their thoughts to direct us to do things even that we don't really want to do. I don't mean that in a nasty way, but just in Betty and Barney's case, they're trying to get away from this thing. We stood at the location on Route 3 in New Hampshire where Barney had his eyes glued to the aliens with binoculars, and he couldn't pull the binoculars away. And then the director takes off, worried, scared, and he goes on a crazy back road, logging road at the time. Now it's paved, but and winds up going someplace where the saucer was on the ground, and they got taken on board. Now, you know, how do you do that? That mental, powerful thinking is all I can say, because I don't know what else to call it. You know, mind to mind, if you will. No devices is what I'm saying. You know, nobody was pointing a thing that caused them to do something. That's kind of an extreme amount of power, which is scary, frankly. I mean,
exactly.
You know, how do you feel about the notion of being somebody being able to control your actions, not just the pictures you see in your head?
Don't like that.
No, I don't either. And yet, would it be surprising if an advanced civilization had developed to that point? You know, we think of our old civilization, thousands of years old, and, you know, you go down the street 39 light years to Zeta Reticuli, and the two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2, are, oh, well, just a cool billion years older than the sun.
Right. Right. Well, we'll have more with nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman when we come back, including new information on the MJ-12 documents. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. And stick around. Don't go anywhere. We're going to learn new information from my guest, Stanton Friedman, regarding the MJ-12 documents and much, much more. It's on the way next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Chris McGill, filling in tonight for George Norrie, our guest, Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist and UFO investigator. Now, Stanton, I understand that there will soon be a new edition of your book, Top Secret Magic, that will be published containing new information about the MJ-12 documents. Now, when is this edition scheduled for release?
It's scheduled, and I use that word advisedly, having dealt with publishers in the past, as I'm sure many of your listeners have, scheduled for September. And I added a new 5,000-word chapter trying to raise a whole bunch of objections that have been raised and dealing with them with new evidence, new data. This includes things like there's a book out, Case MJ-12, which claims that the best argument against the reality of the documents is the fact that the briefing officer is listed as Admiral Roscoe Hillencoder. He was the director of Central Intelligence at the time. But, of course, he was only a rear admiral, so therefore the document must be fake, is the, quote, reasoning, unquote. And as it happens, I was at the Eisenhower Library within the last couple of years and looking for all kinds of goodies, and I'd been referred to some. And I found a bunch of memcons, they're called, memos of conversation put out by General Eisenhower's, I'll call him his staff secretary, Brigadier General Goodpaster. Now, he would take notes at these meetings, which involved both military and civilians. Now, you remember the MJ-12 list had half a dozen military and half a dozen civilians. And the military were two Army, two Navy, two Air Force. Anyway, he lists the attendees at the meetings at the top of the memo, and then he'd sign off. Now, what was interesting indeed was that all the ranks for the military were generic ranks, where the word general, in other words, can include brigadier general, major general, lieutenant general, sure, four-star general, and admiral can include rear admiral, vice admiral, and full admiral. And he called himself General Goodpaster. And he signs this memo, a page or two or three or four later, Brigadier General Goodpaster. And I asked two different archivists at the Eisenhower Library, does this bother you, this use of the generic ranks here? And see, I was, because I was there, and they have a big fat book listing all the military people and what their actual rank was. I mean, some of the names I recognized, of course, but some of them I didn't. What rank was this guy? You know, I could check on all of these. And very rarely was there a four-star, either admiral or general. But here we have somebody referring to himself as general when he himself was a brigadier general. And this is the case in the MJ-12 document, the Eisenhower briefing document. Generals and admirals, there's no signature for Admiral Hillencoder. So this sounds like a great argument and turns out not to be such an argument when you look at the facts.
And now, is this the argument that bloggers have claimed to have shown?
Say that again?
Is this the stance that the bloggers have claimed, you know, that they've come up with proof that the MJ-12 documents are frauds?
I've heard that so many times. Here's the proof. And any time I go to look at those, I find that it isn't proof at all. It's proof of the ignorance of the person writing the memo and the blogger. Now, some stuff that isn't in the new edition of the book, Paul Kimball and a lawyer, and so that people won't misunderstand, my nephew has raised some newer objections, and I don't feel that they hold up either. And I've written one of my monthly MUFON Journal columns. That's a place where I can sound off. I recommend the MUFON Journal, got lots of goodies in it, and I enjoy writing a monthly column there. And I've dealt with several of his objections, and I'll be writing more. He responds, so I respond back. And, you know, with a lawyer, you got to be careful what you say. And the family member, even more careful.
Right.
But I'm still, you know, there's a lot of people who assume absence of evidence is evidence for absence. The things that aren't said, one person raised the objection, well, Vannevar Bush, it doesn't say anything about this in his obituary. And, you know, I pointed out to people, another very important member of the group was Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard University astronomer, who was a total debunker, we thought, on UFOs. And then when I went to Harvard, getting permission from three different people to look through Menzel's papers, I discovered to my total shock, because I didn't like him when he was alive, we had a run-in, and he was saying dumb things about saucers, I thought. But I discovered to my total shock that he was up to his ears in intelligence work, to the point where he could write John Kennedy, President John Kennedy, that had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency and its naval predecessor, 30 years as of 1960, that he had a top-secret ultra clearance with the CIA, that he did classified work for 30 different companies. All this I discovered, none of us knew that any of that stuff. And the interesting thing, absence of evidence, there's an 8-page appreciation of him after he died in Sky and Telescope magazine, because he was a real wheel in astronomy and, you know, Harvard University and all that stuff. And there isn't one word in that 8-page appreciation about all his post-World War II activities requiring a very high security level. 8 pages! So the fact that it isn't mentioned there doesn't mean it's not real. It means nobody had discovered it yet. This is a major problem with a lot of people. Well, it doesn't say so here, so it must not be true. For example, President Eisenhower, in his best-selling book, Mandate for Change, mentions a meeting that he had with President Truman on 18 November 1952. Now, that also happens to be the date of the Eisenhower briefing document. Well, if you're in his book, he talks about his meeting with Truman earlier in the day at the White House. Pictures were taken of the two, you know, the former, the still yes. current president at that time, but the newly elected, the president-elect Eisenhower. And that was an important transition because, as you will recall, that was the first time we had a switch after the atomic bomb came into existence from one party to the other, Cold War, all that sort of thing.
Right.
How do you handle that transition? You know, not easy things. And there is not one word in his discussion of the events of that day about the fact that he went over to the Pentagon and received a high-level security briefing. Now, it is noted in the New York Times article, and it's noted in the files, without giving the details of what was said, of others who were there, General Lawton Collins, the Army Chief of Staff, for example, mentions that he was at a meeting with the president-elect on that day. There are 5 other books that I checked about Eisenhower. You know, there are hundreds of books about him. And they all mention, partly because, as Truman said in his notes, the New York Times photographer, they picked the worst picture, he thought, of the two of them to put in the paper. But anyway, 5 other books say nothing at all about the briefing at the Pentagon about national security matters. So the fact that it isn't mentioned doesn't mean it didn't happen. It means it isn't mentioned.
Right. Right.
You know, Eisenhower, incidentally, was famous for putting as little down on paper as he could. And I talked to a historian from Johns Hopkins University who was working on Ike's papers for many, many years. And he told me, he said, you know, I didn't fully appreciate that until there was a meeting between him and General Matthew Ridgway, commander in Korea, which was happening while this was going on. And looking at Ike's notes on the meeting and file, nothing special happened, no big deal. You look at Ridgway's papers, And it was a knockdown, drag-out argument between the two of them. You'd never know it from Ike's paper.
Now, do you think there's actually more to the MJ-12 documents that are that just hasn't been found yet? Or
Well, an enormous amount more. And, you know, again, this notion of governments can't keep secrets and everything is automatically declassified, pick a number, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years after, that's nonsense. And, you know, I believe I've said this before on the show, but at the Eisenhower Library alone, when I was there a year and a half ago now, there were still 300,000 pages of classified material. He went out of office in 1961, January. The Truman Library still has 45,000 pages of classified material. We don't know what is there. You're not allowed to go through all this stuff, and then they tell you, well, you can't have this or that. You tell them what you want. They bring you the boxes with the papers, and you find withdrawal sheets, lots and lots of them, in which they list. I've had occasions where instead of getting a box, I get three sheets.
So this obviously wasn't
on each listed, you know, memo, top secret, Joe Smith, Tom Jones, January 22nd, 1954. And that's it. You know, you don't know what's there. You can request mandatory classification review, and you may get it 2 years later. You may not get it at all.
You may not get it at all. Now, where does Colonel Philip Corso fall into all this?
Well, that's an interesting question. And again, I get a hard time from people who tell me.
History Channel just had a special on that tonight on the Fast Blast. I was just notified of that. So,
yeah, I've heard that there was a show on, and I might have been in it.
You were in it. Yes, you were.
One of those shows. And I've met Colonel Corso and met his son, Lieutenant Colonel Corso, really, while he was in the service. And I think the book was, how shall I put this? It was a Taking Advantage of the Opportunity book, exploitation book. Came out, you know, the 50th anniversary of Roswell.
Right.
Several of us were supposed to get advanced copies. We didn't. You noticed that the book had no references. There was no substantiation of the many claims. And I also discovered that Lieutenant Colonel Corso, I mean, let's face it, he was an old man at this time. And I'm getting old myself, and I know about something about memory loss. And, you know, the short span memory, I'll tell you in 2 minutes from now what the answer to that question is, you know. But anyway, it turns out that he made claims that simply weren't true. One of them, for example, and I have a copy around here somewhere, he claimed that he was in a sworn statement for an attorney, Peter Kirsten, who led the battle on that early suit against the CIA and then the NSA. This goes back a long time. So he's fought the government under freedom of information. Anyway, he claimed he had been a member of the president's of the National Security Council. Well, he was not a member, never was a member, never attended a meeting. So there was a certain amount of enlargement of his role in a number of things. And matter of fact, there was just a Nobel Prize winner in physics, Kilby, Texas Instruments, who won his Nobel Prize for work done in 58, and that it had to do with, you know, the Intel kind of all the transistors on a chip kind of thing, which was an extraordinarily important development. And Corso was taking credit for having inculcated that from the information that was obtained from the Roswell wreckage into industry, except he wasn't in that role at General Trudeau's Foreign Technology Group at the Pentagon, which there were only two people.
But it has been confirmed that he was within security clearance to have access to the types of information.
I'd rephrase that. He certainly had a security clearance. He was involved with intelligence work. He did liaison work with the National Security Council. He was not a member, and there were only two people in that group, and it was 1960, and here we have a Nobel Prize given for work done in 1958 that he was taking credit for having introduced into industry. So let's put it this way. I am very skeptical about his claims, and the absence of evidence for them, go back to what I said myself, you know, is part of the problem. But he certainly didn't provide any evidence. And remember, The good colonel was not an engineer. He was not a scientist. And the Air Force Foreign Technology Group, and I've seen people get these two groups confused, which was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I had dealings with them. I was project engineer and a contract out of them back in 1960, 61, actually. That was a large group. I made many visits back there. They had dozens of people connected with that group, lots of technical people. They'd had records since 1947. You're going to tell me they did nothing with it? I don't believe right. that for a moment. So the colonel was a nice guy. When I talked to his son, there was a public meeting in Florida. He was saying there was a foot of material that was going to be distributed. Remember, on the internet, he had a deal worked out. You pay so much a month and you get access. And I asked him publicly, was there any classified material in that pile? The answer was no. He also pointed out that his father didn't think these things were from a long ways away because, after all, there were no sleeping, cooking, living facilities on board the saucers. And I did point out that we have these wonderful reports of huge motherships. By huge, I think of one up in the Yukon. We're talking 0.6 to 1 mile, 1.2
miles huge.
Long. That's big to me. I don't know about you, but you see that thing flying around in the sky. And that was based on triangulation from more than 30 witnesses.
Right.
And when you got something that big, that's your aircraft carrier where you sleep and watch movies and eat and do all the other things. And then you have your little Earth excursion modules where you don't need to do any of those things. And there was a long silence and no discussion thereafter about that.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about the Robert Cutler memo that was found in the National Archives?
Well, that's one of it's the only one of the original three documents. The Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman-Forrestal memo, which is page 8 of that, and then the Cutler-Twining memo, which was found at the National Archives, folded in between other folders, in box 189 of entry 267 of record group 341. And it's the only, original. It's an original carbon. In other words, it's there at the National Archives at College Park. Many people have gone there and looked at it, gotten their fingerprints all over it, of course. And it's a brief memo from Robert Cutler. His name is down the bottom. I better qualify that. His name is down the bottom. There is no signature and no //, meaning original signed by. Anyway, it's just a note to General Nathan Twining telling him that a briefing, the MJ-12 Special Studies Project briefing, would take place during an already scheduled meeting instead of after it. Please change your plans accordingly. But it mentions MJ-12. And that has been attacked for all kinds of reasons. I'll give you some quickies. One of them is, the security marking is top secret restricted. That's ridiculous. The government said it wasn't in use at that time. That's a combination of the highest and the lowest. Makes no sense. Forget it. It's obviously a fraud. Fortunately, the General Accounting Office, which was looking for Roswell papers, they published a big report about 400 and some pages long, mostly dull stuff, including letters from me and stuff like that. They published this report and sort of a recounting of what they did to try to find more stuff. And they noted that on December 7th, 1993, they visited a facility and had access to materials up through top secret Air Force facility. And they didn't find any Roswell stuff. However, we noted several instances of the use of top secret restricted, even though we had been told, Majestic 12, that it was not in use at that time, during the same time frame. Now, I contacted three different GAO people. I had talked to them when they were doing all this back years ago. And I said, hey, I need copies of those. Stan, the stuff's still classified. We couldn't copy it. You can't get copies of them. But it's good enough for me if they say so in a public document that they saw those instances. That's one thing.
So you believe this to be true then?
Well, yeah. I also got paid $1,000 from Philip Glass. He claimed that the Pica typeface was inappropriate. It should have been the small elite type. and he had 9 memos to prove it. Well, I was going to the Eisenhower Library. He offered me a special deal. He'd pay me $100 each for every genuine such document with the same size and style type. And to make a very long story short, it'll be in the book, I sent him 14 of these documents. He set a limit, unfortunately, of 10.
Well, we need to take a break, Stanton. Don't go away. Coming up, we'll find out what Stanton thinks of the new book by Nick Redfern, Body Snatchers in the Desert, the story that's supposed to put the lid on the Roswell incidents. That and a lot more coming up next on Coast to Coast AM.